Thank you, Mike and Jeremy and all of you who've contributed to putting together this lovely congregational worship service tonight. It's just a great blessing to be with you again today. And tonight I'll probably do a lot better than I did this morning because Ginger's here, and I seem to do a little better when she's here. And I've got some old friends from Hop Street here, and Coach and his family. It's just good to see them. I want us to think about, you know what's going to happen Tuesday, don't you? We're having an election. Have y'all heard of that? It's been something on television about it rather frequently. And, you know, we're going to elect the President of the United States. And he has a specific, or he or she in this case, has a specific role to fill that is delineated in a document called the Constitution of the United States of America. And we certainly pray that that document stays consistently paid attention to over the next number of years. But I think it's important for you and me to notice that we, although we have a president, we try to be good citizens, don't we? We certainly do. And we try to obey the laws. Unless the laws go against God's law, we'll obey the laws. That's what Romans 13 basically tells us to do. So we try to do that. But you know, we have a king. We have a sure enough king. And that's something I think we ought to remember. It keeps things in perspective about this election coming up. Now, the book of John, one of my favorite books, and I'm teaching it when I have an opportunity these days. The first 11 chapters of the book of John are given primarily to covering the seven miracles that Jesus did, which are there to encourage people to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And, you know, John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, certainly do describe that specifically, where John said, "And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name." So that sort of takes the first half of the book of John. And then you get to John chapter 12 to the, at least chapter 18, maybe 19. You've got the lead up to the crucifixion. And in chapter 12, you have in verses 12 through 15, you have something very specific having to do with the coronation of Jesus Christ. Now, I don't know if you've, my family, like a lot of people in this part of the country, we come from the British Isles, Northern Europe, primarily the British Isles. That's our heritage in terms of Europe is concerned. And so, you know, when they get all worked up over there in Great Britain and they're crowning the new king, we pay attention to that a little bit. You know, not intensely, but somewhat, because it's, and then we've studied our European history, our Western civilization. We pay attention to that sort of thing. So we understand a little bit about the ideas associated with an earthly king. But Jesus is not an earthly king. He is the king of the earth. He is the king of everything on and in the earth. And he is the king of everybody on the earth, whether they will admit it or not. But in terms of faithful Christians, he is definitely our king. And one of the things that's fascinating to me is the coronation of Jesus. That is when Jesus was coming into Jerusalem. You know, he'd spent some time in Bethany or Bethphage. It just depends on how it's called in a particular time. Because he had friends over there. You know, Lazarus and Mary and Martha, they were his friends. You know, like you and I have friends, Jesus had friends like that. You know, he was just as much a man as we are, except he was God also. And of course, I tend to believe he was probably more of a man than most of us or any of us. But he was coming from there into Jerusalem. And the text says in John chapter 12, that's where we're going to go first, John chapter 12 and verse 12, text says, "The next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast Let me stop there for a minute. There was a rabbi. No, it wasn't a rabbi either. This guy got his information from a rabbi. But there was a governor. This is not Pontius Pilate, but this is between the time of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus and the destruction of Jerusalem. There was a governor of Palestine, Roman province of Palestine, who said that during Passover there were as many as 250,000 lambs in Jerusalem. Boy, that's a lot of baa black sheep, isn't it? Because I don't know how many of them were black. But 250,000 lambs. Well, if you have one lamb for 10 people at Passover, doesn't that run out to about 2.5 million people? Well, there are people who estimate that at Passover, when it was a well-attended Passover and there wasn't anything getting in the way, any war or anything like that, 2.5 million people. So when the text says the next day a great multitude that had come to the feast, that's the kind of multitude we're talking about, 2.5 million people. They say there are 1 million people in our Huntsville metro area, probably a lot more than that. I don't keep up with it. My son does. But you think of 2.5 million people, that's a lot of folks. And look what they did. They heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. Now, it doesn't say 2.5 million people in the text. It just says a great multitude. So a great multitude heard that Jesus was coming. And what did they do? Well, they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried out, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel." They took these palm fronds. You know, we have friends in the denominational world who wear a palm leaf, you know, leading up to Easter time. That's where that tradition comes from. And there's nothing biblical telling us to do that. But what is interesting to note is that this spreading of palm fronds on the road was a tradition done when a king or some other highly important functionary was coming to your community. You didn't want them walking on rough roads. You didn't want them tripping over into mud puddles and so forth. So they put the palm fronds out. That was a tradition. Well, they did that for Jesus here. And they did it because of the great respect that they had for him. And then what they said, "Hosanna," which means save now, save now. He says, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel." The common people here, they believed that Jesus was the king. And so they were welcoming him in. Then Jesus, when he had found a young donkey, now we know from reading about this over time, he had already set this up. He had set up the arrangement so that there would be a donkey available for him to come in and ride in. Now, this is also part of a tradition associated with the way to honor an individual, the riding on a donkey. This is something from secular history and that sort of thing. Probably a little bit more about that later. But what we see here is the greatest spiritual event of history was coming together in front of the eyes of these people. Now, we're going to go into this from a number of points of view, but first three things I want us to mention is things to remember about the day that Jesus entered Jerusalem. First of all, it showed the courage of Jesus. Now, we know that the Word became flesh and dwelt among men. We know John 1:14. And he is the Word, he is God, and he dwelt among men. But he also, according to Hebrews 4 and other places, he's also a man. And there was a lot to fear for him coming into Jerusalem. Because even though the people loved him, the leadership of the city of Jerusalem, the leadership of the Jews, did not love him at all. Indeed, we might even say that the bosses hated him. Because, you know, this business, the people viewed him as being king. They wanted to be the rulers of those people. And why did they want that? Because that was the way they made their livings. And they wanted the money that was associated with being in control of taxes and fees and funds and the things associated with the temple. Talking about the high priest and many of the Levites, not all of them. Some of the Levites were faithful to God. And the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court that ruled Judea, not all of them were bad actors, but most of them were, as we read in the text. So he was entering a city that had hostile leadership. The people loved him. The bosses did not love him. And you look at this passage, go back to John chapter 11, verses 47 and following. The text says there, "Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, 'What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.'" So they didn't want to see the people following Jesus. They were afraid they were going to lose their jobs. They're afraid that the Romans would come in and see some sort of rebellion in place, and they would lose their positions. And one of them, a fellow named Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." Now, this Caiaphas is a character. He is something else. You know, I got to go to Jerusalem a few years ago due to the kindness of other people, and they took us on a tour. We went to Caiaphas's house. That's what they call it. They didn't know for sure it was Caiaphas's house, but they said it was the residence of someone like the high priest. And then, of course, it helps tourism business if you can put a name on it, so they called it Caiaphas's house. Boy, it's a beautiful place. Well, you couldn't tell because it was a ruin, but it was huge, and they had reconstructions and models and that sort of thing. Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that is expedient. It is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." This he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. He didn't think that Jesus was going to die for the nation of the people. He didn't think he was dying. You know, the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost, Luke 19:10. He wasn't thinking of it like that. He was thinking it's expedient for one man to die for us to keep our jobs, to keep our places, so that we can be the rulers of Jerusalem. See, still, Jesus knew their plans. Jesus is God. He knows everything. But he came anyway. He had a lot of courage. So I think one thing I want to take away from this is the courage of Jesus. And then the things that he did, walking on the palm front, riding the donkey. Jesus could have said at the beginning of this process, somewhere in John 10, 11, 12, he could have said, "Well, listen, I'm just a prophet. I'm just like John the Baptist. I'm just coming in here to preach to you. Don't get upset. I'm just going to preach like these other fellows have been preaching." He didn't do that. By the things which he did and the claims that he made by fulfilling prophecy specifically the way he did, he claimed to be the Messiah. He claimed to be the King. And then the last thing I want us to note right here is the appeal of Jesus. The appeal of Jesus. Riding a donkey immediately tied him to the common people. Jesus didn't come to town on a war horse. He didn't come in like the leader of a Roman legion. He didn't come in like a Syrian king or a Syrian king or an Egyptian leader in a carriage or anything. He came in on a donkey. Now, I don't know. I've never known many donkeys. I've seen a few. And I told Ginger the other day, if we lived in the right place, I'd love to have a donkey. They look like they could take care of themselves and so forth, you know. And they nuzzle up on you and stuff. Now, I may not know anything about them, and they make kick you to pieces, as far as I know. But the point is, the people realized that Jesus was coming in on a meek animal as opposed to a big horse or riding an animal that would be a symbol of war. The donkey symbol of peace. This was God's Son coming to save whoever would obey the gospel, so people identified with him. He was not haughty, but he came to do what only he could do. The blood of Jesus Christ is the only thing that saves us, 1 Peter 1:18 and 19. That's the only hope that we have. He didn't come on that war horse. He came on an animal of peace. So we think about Jesus in terms of his courage, his claim, and his appeal. But also, I want us to think about this matter of crowns. Now, the prophecy about the donkey is in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. But we think about Jesus being our king, and we are his spiritual kingdom. Now, have you ever seen crowns that the kingdoms of Europe use? I had a chance to see that one time, too, going to England anyway, and seeing those crowns, big, heavy, ornate affairs. Looked like they probably weighed 30, 40 pounds. I don't know how much they weigh, but I don't think I'd want to carry one on my head. Now, the Romans didn't use that kind of crown. The Romans just wove together some vegetation, the laurels and so forth like that, put that on your head. That was a Roman crown. You see the picture of Caesar. He's got these pieces of vegetation wrapped around his head. Jesus didn't get that kind of crown, did he? What kind of crown did Jesus get? He got a crown of thorns. But he, before that, he was offered an earthly crown. Matthew chapter 4 and verse 8, the devil himself, Satan himself, the temptation of Jesus, took him up in a high place, said, look out here, I'll give you all of this. You'll be king of all of this. What did Jesus do? He rejected Satan's offer. Then in John 6, 15, the people that loved him were going to take him and make him king. They were just going to put him at the head of a phalanx of folks, and he's going to take him in, make him king. We'll put him in office, one might say. He rejected that earthly crown. Said, nope, that's not for me. That's not what I'm doing. That's not what I am about. But he was given a crown of scorn, of rejection. But he accepted that crown. You know it. You think of it as a crown of thorns. Now, I go out and I work in the yard, and you know how it is when you get old. Your skin gets thin, and I get up around the bushes, and the bushes grab you, and you come in, and Ginger says, well, you're bleeding again, you know, that kind of thing. And that's just from a little rose bush or two. You know, the crown of thorns that Jesus was made to wear was not some little rose thorns. These were big thorns. These are the kind of thorns you see in the Middle East. Matthew chapter 27, verse 29 says, and when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head, and a reed in his right hand, and bowed the knee before him, mocking him, saying, hail, the King of the Jews. Why did he accept this? And, you know, I've seen what people say. Of course, I wasn't there, obviously. None of us were. I don't know what those thorns were like, but some say that some of those thorns this long. And they jammed them down on his head, and you know that just had to hurt like the blazes. That's what I mentioned from Matthew 27 is also in John 19. Bible says, then came Jesus forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, which they put on him to mock him. Purple is the color of royalty. But Pilate stole something from them. He said, behold the man. Which if I remember my Latin, is ecce homo. And Pilate was not a believer in Jesus, at least not at this point in time. But he knew. He knew the Jews were just out to kill him because they viewed him as a threat to them. So in order to gig them a little bit, you know, to tease them a little bit, he said, "Behold the man." He knew they wouldn't like it. That crown of thorns was meant to be painful, repudiating, and insulting. But Jesus accepted it. He accepted it. He rejected an earthly crown, accepted that crown of thorns. But what did he receive? He received a crown of glory and of honor. I love in that connection, 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning with verse 15. 1 Timothy 6, beginning with verse 15. The text says, "Which in his times he shall show who is the blessed and only potentate, the King of kings, the Lord of lords, who only has immortality, dwelling in the light which no man can approach unto, whom no man hath seen nor can see, to whom be honor and power everlasting." Our Jesus is our King. He received that crown, and that turned out to be the crown of glory. Of course, he has a heavenly crown, spiritual crown in heaven. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 7, "Thou madest him a little lower than the angels. Thou crownest him with glory and honor, and didst set him over the works of thy hands." What are the works of God's hands? Ask yourself in your mind, what are the works of God's hands? Isn't it everything? It's everything. Jesus is set over all of that. Verse 9 of Hebrews 2 says, "But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he by the grace of God to taste death for every man." What a beautiful thing to think about. The crowns of Jesus. Rejected an earthly crown, accepted that crown of thorns and scorn, but received a crown of glory and honor. The Bible teaches, my dear friends, and this ought to encourage us, because no matter what happens in this life, we have promised to us an incorruptible crown. We're going to leave this place, and one day we're going to go home to be with God, and we're going to receive our crown. The crown of life. What did John write on the Isle of Patmos? "Be thou faithful unto death, thou wilt receive a crown of life." Philippians 4, 1 and following, all the way down through verse 6, talks about a crown of joy. We have promised to us a crown of glory. And I guess the part of the Bible that teaches about our crown that I love the most is I think about old Paul. Old Paul, just worn out, absolutely worn out doing his work. The people that wrote in the second century, the first century is the Bible century, right? Up through 30-33, the establishment of the church. Then you got the destruction of Jerusalem in 70. You got the work of the apostles leading from the time the church was established up to the destruction of Jerusalem and for a period of time after. Most scholars believe you have John working up until about 90-95. Could have been earlier, but that's about where we end up on most of that. Hebrews is a little bit earlier than that. So you have, in that first century, you've got Paul working a lot of the time. We think he was probably finally killed in the early 60s of the first century. By that time, he had worn himself out. People who wrote in the second century, a group of individuals called the Church Fathers. They're really not Church Fathers of anything, but they're called that. And they wrote in the period before the Nicene Creed was written. And that creed was written in 325 A.D. But some of the earliest of them will try to describe people who wrote in the second century. They'll describe the apostle based on what maybe their father or their grandfather saw. And what they say, he was just a scrawny old fella, just about worn to pieces. Well, based on what he did, I can just about believe that, what he went through. And he had Timothy. He loved Timothy. Timothy loved him. Luke was one of his sidekicks, great friend. But he wrote 2 Timothy to Timothy. And he told him there, he said, "For I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith." That's what we ought to be doing. Fighting a good fight. Finishing our course. We don't have his course. He didn't have ours. Finish our course. Keep the faith. And then you have verse 8. "Henceforth, there is laid up for me." I love that. Don't you, Jeremy? They put it aside. They laid it up for us. "A crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day." Now, the reason I say laid it aside for us, we're talking about we're talking about Timothy's crown here. But it's not just laid up for him. He says, "Not to me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing." In other words, Jesus' reality. We love that. That crown of righteousness is waiting for you. That crown of righteousness is waiting for me. The crowns of Jesus, great lessons associated therewith. But I tell you what I'm looking forward to is that crown. And I know it's not physical, because righteousness is not physical, is it? What the life we live ends up being a physical life if we live it in righteousness. What is righteousness? Doing what God says is right. Why do we want to do what God says is right? Because whatever God says is right, that's righteousness. Crown of righteousness, which we're going to have one day. Now, that crown's promised to everybody who's a faithful child of God. You can't be perfect. You can't be, sinlessly perfect. But you can be faithful. "Be thou faithful unto death, you'll receive a crown of life." Now, what does that mean? That means you got weaknesses. And if you come up short, what you do is you ask God to forgive you. You repent of your sin, and then you ask God to forgive you. It's just as simple as that. It's not complicated. That's 1 John chapter 1, verses 5 through 10. It's not complicated. But you have to be in a relationship with Jesus, the relationship with Jesus, in order to be able to ask him to forgive you. And that relationship begins when you're baptized into Christ based on your faith, your penitence of your past sins, your confession that Jesus is the Christ. Then you go into that watery grave of baptism and you're raised up to walk in newness of life. I've seen some of you in this room do that very thing. What a blessing it is to know we're on the way to getting our crown. If that's the case with you, you thank the Lord when you pillow your head. If you're not set up for that, won't you come forward? Let the elders here pray with you and for you. See if we can help you on the way to receiving your crown. As together we stand and sing.